Democratic presidential candidates are at ground zero for climate risk. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The debate begins tonight. How many times will moderators ask about sea level rise? How much time will candidates discuss these issues? Well, last night we hosted our second WLRN Sundial and Miami Herald Town Hall focused entirely on that topic.
We have two tribes. We have the hell no, we won't go kind of people. And then we have the people who just can't wait for me to stop talking to ask me, so when should I sell?
Today on the program, we bring you an informative and at times tense conversation about climate challenges ahead.
Connect the dots for the audience.
All right. Well, we got some media here. Jenny, come on in.
First of all, like hurricane intensification, I haven't found a scientist who can say, yes, I know Harvey was more intense and had more rain.
All of that next on Sundial. First, the news.
Well, hello, hello, and welcome to the WLRN Sundial and the Miami Herald Town Hall. This is our second evening doing this. We're doing these town halls right before the Democratic debates. As we were talking about earlier, 20 candidates are going to try to convince you, the voter, that they are the person that you should be voting for. But in these town halls, we are covering two big issues we hope that they are going to discuss in those debates. We talked about immigration yesterday. Today we're talking about climate risk. Not climate change, but climate risk, because we're talking about all the things that come with climate change, the issues that we're dealing with, which include sea level rise, drought, and all these other challenges that are going to force us to make a lot of changes and some tough decisions. We got a lot to cover, so I'm going to introduce our panel. I'm going to start here on my left going, I guess, left to right, your left to right, our WLRN environmental reporter, Jenny Stiletovich. The Miami Herald climate change reporter, Alex Harris. Climate change educator and founder of the Clio Institute, Caroline Lewis. Florida International University professor of biology and the mayor of South Miami, Phil Stoddard. And Republican state representative representing District 120, also chair of the Agriculture and Natural Resources Appropriations Subcommittee, Holly Reshinesky. I want to jump in and start this conversation. Caroline Lewis, let me begin with you. Help us understand where we are right now on this issue. What is the severity? We hear about urgency. We hear about the severity. A new report came out yesterday. Maybe we have it wrong on sea level rise. It may be worse. Where are we right now?
We're in deep trouble. I think if you look at historic data, you need to go back somewhere between 3 and 20 million years ago to find a time on the planet when we had as many heat-trapping greenhouse gases in the atmosphere as we do now. And so the hubris of humankind to deny the science that's screaming at us is what is frustrating for me. And if I had my druthers, the urgency would be everybody's to own. And climate denial would be a liability for anybody running for office in any election.
We're in deep trouble, as you say. Phil Stoddard, as one of the politicians on this board, I'm wondering, do you think city planners, city leaders, county leaders, are they doing enough? Is the conversation, do they see it that way?
That's a laughable question. The answer is absolutely not. To build off of what Caroline said, 15 million years ago, when we had this much CO2 in the atmosphere, the ocean was about up to the top of a 20-story building. Okay, so that's where we are going. And no, there is no politician in America who's doing enough to address that situation.
Let me push back on you a little bit. Here in South Florida, what is unique is we have resiliency officers, different counties, different cities. At least they put somebody in position to talk about that part of the issue.
Right.
Is that not enough, at least to start?
Well, you know, I was at the rollout of the Resilient 305 plan, and Jenny and I talked about this, and it's an aspirational plan, but there's no budget for it. I mean, you know, at the municipal level, when we have a plan, we have a budget. Our plan says, here's what we're going to do, and this is what it's going to cost, and then we do our capital improvement plan, and we put money towards it. or we plan to put money towards it over a number of years. There is no money associated with the Resilient 305 plan. To me, it's not a plan. It's a wish.
Holly Rashine, I wonder in Tallahassee, what's the conversation? And I think what's always interesting about politics in Tallahassee, politics in D.C., is that you have representatives from a lot of different places. They, of course, are worried about their backyard. But I wonder what the conversation is right now in Tallahassee on this issue.
For sure, Lewis, and thank you. If I can just maybe add to that, if you have a plan but you don't fund it, it's very hard to move forward, right? It's very same in Everglades restoration. But we are finally, and I'm very encouraged to share with you that we are starting to have that conversation, at least at a state level. I can't really speak to D.C., but in Tallahassee, we are allowed to say the words climate change now. So
under the last governor, that was one of the controversies is that we couldn't even say climate change?
Sure,
but we can
climate
now?
climate change. We are allowed to say that at a state level. And you see now with the new administration what a breath of fresh air when it comes to environmental issues we are seeing under Governor Ron DeSantis. He has made the environment, Everglades restoration, water quality a huge priority, not only for him but for our entire state.
See, something interesting too, for folks who don't know, she covers the Keys. And this probably more than Miami, the most vulnerable part of the state.
I would say that we are ground zero for sea level rise. Big Pine Key, for example, is going to be the majority of it, we could say, not the majority of it, but a large portion of it will be underwater by 2050. That puts endangered species in peril, key deer, marsh rabbits, you name it. We've got some big issues down there.
Not to ask to call anybody out, but I wonder if you have conversations with people, I don't care what party, but people who say, you know what? I've got my own problems. How do you convince them that you've got to care about my area as much as I should care about yours?
Sure, and again, the Florida Keys and South Florida as a whole, we're happy to be a leader in this issue, whether it comes to whether we're talking about flood mitigation, building codes, coral reef protection. We are, I would say, taking a leadership role in a big way, and I think that you see the commitment just from a state level in a big way this year in terms of water quality and water quality funding, Everglades restoration. Recently, the governor asked us for $6 million for the Florida Resilient Coastline Initiative. We got to $5.5 million, but I think the tide is certainly turning in a positive way.
Alex Harris, in covering, and I want to come back to what Mr. Stoddard said, is he thinks not enough, not even close. But help us understand briefly, and Jenny, I want to ask you this too, is what cities, communities in South Florida are doing right now, how do they view this? They have the resiliency offices, but is that just about preparing for what's coming, or is there a conversation about the climate risk and all the other things that come with it?
Right. So South Florida is unlike a lot of other places in the United States and maybe even singular in that we have moved beyond the is it going to happen discussion, and we're talking about what are we going to do about it. So we've got resilience officers, like you mentioned, in Miami-Dade County, in the city of Miami, in the city of Miami Beach. And that's a designated person in the government whose job it is to think about resiliency. How are we going to adapt? What infrastructure changes need to happen? And they have varying levels of activity. In Miami, I know, for instance, Jane Gilbert is working on a stormwater master plan, and she's talking about, you know, how to implement a lot of what the city wants to do in terms of making it more sustainable and looking at climate risk head on. And they have kind of a benefit that a lot of other places don't have, and that we just passed the Miami Forever Bond a couple years ago, and that's a couple $100 million to address this issue. Miami Beach, on the other hand, has a couple $100 million, 500, 600, and they're investing in pumps, they're raising roads, they're doing the infrastructure projects. And it's sort of the stuff that needs to happen, and some people are ahead of the gun on that. Miami Beach really jumped ahead of a lot of other people. But some of the other smaller municipalities in Miami-Dade County aren't doing as much, and that's kind of looking toward county leadership to show them what they want to do.
Jenny Stoladovich, in all the years you've been covering the environment, I'd like your take on, I guess, how this issue will come up or how it should come up during this conversation for the candidates. I mean, what's the one thing you hope they at least pop up and talk about?
Well, I hope they focus a little bit on the causes and not so much the solution that has to do with infrastructure. I feel like down here in South Florida, we talk a lot about pumps, raising roads, doing things that make it more livable, but we're not focusing so much on the causes. the, you know, what are we doing about building efficiency? What are we doing to limit greenhouse gases? That it's easier to build a bridge than it is to pass a carbon tax. And it feels like some of those harder issues need to be addressed. And, you know, they're big ticket items. I don't know. They're a harder sell.
Holly Rashan, let me come to this. I think South Florida seems a little different to me. I think people who live here understand because we're in it, we feel it, we know what's coming. It's already happening. It's not something that's coming. And so I think that when it comes to the political side of this, I think that everybody, regardless of your party, gets it. I want to know why there's still a pushback. And you said it's a breath of fresh air, new governor, new attitude. But in all fairness, your party, generally speaking, has given us the biggest pushback on the issue of climate risk, climate change. And I'm wondering why? Why is that still an issue? Or do you think that it is really changing?
I truly believe that it is changing. And maybe in the past, I couldn't say the same thing. And again, I'm...
And by the way, because I said South Florida is different, a lot of Republicans down in South Florida get it.
Yeah.
And they're fighting
well,
for
it. Well, we live it.
Right. So, okay.
Mm-hmm. And I don't see climate change or the environment or whatever, sea level rise, as a partisan issue. But again, I live very closely to these issues. And I think it's a matter of education. You know, North Florida is very different from Central Florida. Central Florida is very different from South Florida. Then you have the East and the West Coast. You have the Panhandle, which just went through a devastating natural disaster. I think they're going to learn a lot of lessons from South Florida when it comes to building back resiliently, as we did maybe post-Hurricane Andrew and so on and so forth. And then even more lessons that we learned, for example, in the Keys after Hurricane Irma. I think that the word resiliency is new to everybody. It used to kind of be a buzzword. It was like the cool thing to say. But what does that really mean? We have Resiliency Florida, for example, organizations like that popping up that are really taking the lead and charging forward on this critical issue.
So we don't have anybody from D.C., but we have heard from people from D.C. We recently spoke with former Republican Congressman Carlos Curbelo about how Republicans in D.C. view this issue. Here's what he said.
I think back, and this is not an excuse for Republicans, but I think it certainly helps us understand why Republicans got to the point we're at now. I actually think we bottomed out 2014, 2015. After the 2000 election, you know, Bush beat Al Gore. Al Gore was ridiculed and earned the disdain of a lot of people on the American right, and then he became the face of American environmentalism. And a lot of Republicans just assumed that if Al Gore, if this is his cause, then we must oppose it. Of course, that doesn't make sense, but that's how it all started.
Caroline Lewis, let me start with you. I mean, that was almost 20 years ago. I'm wondering, why does that rift between parties still exist? Why are we still debating the science and not debating solutions?
I don't know. I think everybody says education is the answer. And I have been an educator my entire life, a school teacher and principal.
So you've had the chance to travel and try to educate. What do you see?
And education does not change behavior, unfortunately. If it did, everybody would be, you know, acting in the public's interest. I consider public elected leaders public servants, and you serve the public by acting in their interest. This disdain for the science is really troubling. You know, there's a documentary called The Years of Living Dangerously. That's what we're doing right now. We write letters to the future. We talk about 50, 10, 20 years from now, and I've got to tell you, I called this denial of climate science in 2003 up in the New York area. I refer to this as crimes against humanity. We talk about education, and, you know, when I started the Clio Institute in 2010, it was a very lonely tent. It was Clio and the scientists like Hal Wanlest and John Van Leer screaming and yelling. Well, it's a much bigger, fuller tent now. But you know what's missing? You media people. You're not connecting the dots for the public. You're not doing a good enough job when you're reporting on the rate at which a hurricane intensifies. You're not connecting that. When you talk about food and water vulnerability and home affordability and gentrification, connect the dots for the audience.
All right. Well, we got some media here. Jenny, come on in.
First of all, like hurricane intensification, there is science showing that hurricanes are expected and projected to become more intense. The hurricanes we've had so far, I haven't found a scientist who can say, yes, I know Harvey was more intense and had more rain because of climate change. We connect the dots that scientists have researched and found facts.
Jenny, you're not the role model. You're a role model compared to what I'm talking about. You know, no, it's not about you, and it's not about saying something is caused. But there's a correlation, and there's a prediction that we're going to go from Hurricane 1 to Hurricane 5 pretty fast. Everybody tells you that that's going to happen. So if it has happened, you cannot say climate change made that happen. But the likelihood of it happening is going to continue to increase. Yes,
what they're showing is a nice upwards curve in the surface temperatures in the Gulf, okay? And that curve isn't happening on its own. It's being driven by extra heat, and that's what's spinning the storms up faster. So, I mean, this is like saying today's weather is because of a changing climate. The weather goes like this, right? And so when you're in it, you can't say it's climate. Today it's weather.
But the fact that
we've had record temperatures 2 days ago, and we keep having those record temperatures, that's climate.
We're going to get a question here from the audience in a second, but coming back to what you said, because I'm media, and I'm here. And Alex, jump in too, please. I want to hear from you on this. I want to know exactly what is it you want to hear or see from the media on the coverage. But Alex, I mean, you know, covering the environment, what are the discussions that we have with editors about how we do this and what message we get out?
Right. So there's definitely a movement that I think is a positive one mm-hmm. among the climate community to say, hey, mention it more often. When you're talking about housing affordability and you can say, hey, there's a possibility that climate gentrification is an issue in this neighborhood. And there are times when you can say you're experiencing a heat wave. That heat wave, you're going to have more of those in the future.
Let me do this real quickly mm-hmm. because we want to get one question in from the audience, and then we have to take a break. I'm a little bit over, but we're going to keep this conversation going in the next segment. Go ahead and introduce yourself and then give us your question.
Hi, I'm Cindy from Pinecrest, and my question is, where do you think that the county should invest in order to protect our most vulnerable populations? Can you give the top three areas?
Where should the county invest? Phil,
housing.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
I'll just throw one out. Housing affordability.
Philip Stoddard.
Education and jobs.
Holly, do you want to chime in?
I always like to chime in about infrastructure, and I know changing tides, but I think infrastructure in Miami-Dade County, there's a large amount of aging infrastructure, especially when it comes to wastewater or stormwater.
Thank you so much for the question. On that note, I have to take a quick break. We're going to come back. Let's continue this conversation because it was getting very interesting. Again, this is the WLRN Sundial and the Miami Herald Town Hall Conversation on Climate Risk. We'll be right back. Welcome back to this WLRN Sundial and Miami Herald Town Hall. Tonight's event, we're talking about climate risk, and there's a lot to cover with this issue, so we're going to try to get as much in as we can. We have a great panel. Let me reintroduce them. Again, WLRN's environmental reporter, Jenny Stiletovich, the Miami Herald's climate change reporter, Alex Harris, climate change educator and founder of the Clio Institute, Caroline Lewis, FIU professor of biology and the mayor of South Miami, Phil Stoddard, and Republican State Representative Holly Rashin. I do want to mention, because I didn't get to say this before, WLRN is joining up with the Miami Herald, the South Florida Sun Sentinel, the Tampa Bay Times, the Palm Beach Post, and the Orlando Sentinel in a partnership to cover climate change. Our news organizations are going to work together to report the stories from across the state. So, Caroline Lewis, I hope we do a better job now with that. So, we've got a question from the audience. Please step up. Introduce yourself.
My name's Alexandra. I'm actually from down in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. What are the possible roles of classroom educators? I am a high school teacher, in creating a push or urgency for the stakeholders. So what can we do to create like this sense of understanding? What outreach can we do? Because obviously, like you said, the just knowing the facts is not a push enough.
Well, I love you already. I would say the current youth movement led by Greta Thunberg, the young 16-year-old from Sweden who's been on a personal climate strike, her voice is resonating with many. And I've been organizing teachers through CLIO for climate across the curriculum so K-12 teachers can access it. But these kids are demanding it, and now their teachers are reaching out for training. So we will be offering climate 101s for teachers and interested students, and I'd love to give you my card so I can have definitely one in your school and in your region for you.
Holly, please.
And thank you for being an educator, and you have one of the hardest and best jobs on the planet. And we had a similar situation in the Keys, the health of the Florida Bay, right? That's kind of a big deal. It's not the climate change, but still it's connected. And I had a number of students from Montessori, from Key Largo School, all the way down to Key West, reach out on these letter writing campaigns. And then they would do public projects where they would go and they would share the news of what the needs are of the Florida Bay and how we can promote it. And we listen.
Thank you so much. Great question. Thank you. There was a report from the Center for Climate Integrity that came out recently that said the U.S. will have to spend more than $400 billion, in the next 20 years for seawalls. Florida has the greatest cost, $76 billion. But here's the thing. Seawalls don't work everywhere. You can't build them for every city. Holly Rashan, let me start with you. We can't just build a wall around the Keys, right?
No, we cannot. Do not support that. Thank you.
Okay.
As a boating community, that number almost seems insurmountable, especially in the time frame that we've been giving. And I think that we, again, going back to a plan and properly funding it, I think we've got to have a targeted approach. And what that is, I can't answer that. There's a lot more.
But know. What are the conversations right now when it comes to protecting the Keys? What is it then?
Sure, and we do. We have a number of, if you can call them, resiliency officers and folks that work on climate change and putting together this plan for the Keys. And what works in Key West may not work in Marathon. What works in Marathon may not work in the village of Alamorada and so on and so forth, and up the coast of Florida. And I think getting everybody at the table, for example, the climate change summit, where we've got the four counties of Palm Beach, Broward County, Miami-Dade County, Monroe, we've been extremely successful getting everybody to the table and discussing what everybody's doing, what options are on the table. And we're actually seeing other areas across the state, like in Tampa, are kind of modeling their response to climate change and sea level rise after us.
Phil Stoddard, you wanted to say something.
Yeah, can we agree that the marine environment is important to us? Mm-hmm. Anybody disagree with that in this room?
No.
Okay.
I doubt you're going to get a disagreement
then,
in this room.
Then if we all think the marine environment is important, we have to protect the intertidal zones and the shallow water zones because that's where the productivity all comes from. And if you put in a seawall, high tide and low tide become two wet points on a wall, and you have lost your intertidal. It's gone. And China has destroyed half of their intertidal zone by putting up seawalls. And it's wiping out entire migratory pathways of shorebirds that have migrated from the Arctic to the Southern Hemisphere for millions of years. And are we going to make that same mistake, too, by putting up seawalls? I sure as heck hope not.
Alex Harris.
So when we talk about seawalls, something a lot of people like to bring up is the way the Dutch protect themselves, and they do a lot of seawalls. They do levees, they do these beautiful giant gates that block rivers and stop water. And people like to think about exporting that over here and using these kind of gray concrete solutions to solve our problems. But something that Southeast Florida has unusually compared to everyone else is we're kind of on this giant concrete sponge. The water can come up from underneath too, so the wall won't really help you because it can come from above, come from the ocean, and come from underneath. So what people like to look at for solutions instead of these gray concrete seawalls is living shorelines, is berms, it's, you know, having mangroves that can actually, you know, grow and protect you and also filter the water. And these are the kind of thoughts people have to think about too. They're in some cases cheaper. Mangroves are cheaper than a seawall would be.
So Miami Beach right now is they've got the pumps. They're trying to move water around. They're trying to raise roads. Mm-hmm. Is that a good part of the plan?
So there's a lot of pushback on that right now. So Miami Beach kind of jumped ahead of the curve and said, we need to do something. We're going to elevate our roads to be above, you know, a certain height of sea level. They are talking about, you know, having these pumps that keep the roads clean, keep them clear, you know, all about retaining real estate value and livability. But that's not always the best option because, you know, you still end up with water on your roads. You still end up with washing all of that pollutants and dog poop and oil and all off the roads. And Jenny did a wonderful series on this. These pumps can push that pollutants directly into the ocean and change water quality.
Jenny Selanovic, what was the, there was also a story you had too on the water management district looking at replacing old pumps.
Right.
Where is that? And I mean, how do they have that conversation?
Well, they have flood control issues also apply to saltwater intrusion. They use pumps and canals to keep freshwater levels high and saltwater from coming in. Those pumps, as sea levels rise, are not able to handle all that capacity. So they're looking at, and they're going to, started looking at it, things kind of like got put to the side. Now they're readdressing those pumps and taking another look at how many of them they're going to have to replace and at how much it's going to cost.
We did get a question, I believe, on Facebook. This from Scott. Scott says, the Miami Herald published an editorial on the need for climate change debate, but made it sound like sea level rise will stop if we make changes. Won't Florida be covered with water in the future no matter what we do? So to the panel, are there parts of Florida that will simply be uninhabitable?
Well, it depends if you want to live with 60 feet of water over the top of you or not. But if you were to come back in 2,000 years, yes, we'll be underwater, but we live here now. And what's happening in the now is that we're talking, the changes we make in carbon now will affect the rate of sea level rise. They'll affect the rate of melting. It matters tremendously what we do now.
So let's not go 2,000 years. Let's do this. Let's go 50 years. Some people in the audience will still be alive to see that, or at least the next generation.
Yes.
So
what we do today will matter in 30 years. It'll matter in 50 years.
Okay.
It's in our hands today.
All right. Coming back, and Alex, I mean, because they were calling out the Miami Herald, so you get a chance to respond to this too, please. Caroline Lewis, let me start with you, though. The interesting point to this is, if the water's coming, then no matter what, do we just have to accept maybe some of this area is going to be uninhabitable?
Yes, but we want to stay here as safely as possible for as long as possible. And nothing is wrong with that model if the economy can support it. So the Clio Institute had an incredible symposium where we brought in the industry, the economy, engine to tell us how much money we're bringing in still because we're nourishing beaches. Do you think beach renourishment of $11 million is worth it if one storm takes it away? The answer is yeah, because you bring in billions of dollars of tourism having spent $11 million on beach renourishment. So it's a cost-benefit game we're playing. I would say to you, if we can give Southeast Florida, where we live now, 20, 30, 40 good years where everybody comes and thinks and solves problems here. But eventually we will have to reach.
Let me come back to what you said at the very beginning. We're in deep trouble.
Yes.
So does that mean, because I'm going back to what Scott said, is some damage inevitable no matter what we do now? All right, Alex Harris, real quickly, because I know they were calling out the Miami Herald on that.
Right, so they're kind of right and kind of wrong. So if you shut down every single combustion engine in the entire world the minute this panel is over, because they were overstruck by how important climate change is, there would still be sea level rise. There would still be, the world would still get hotter. It's all still going to happen. Just like Stoddard is saying, the rate of which it's going to happen and how much is going to happen is the question. And yes, there are going to be parts of South Florida that are uninhabitable, and it could happen sooner rather than later. But the thing is that nobody wants to leave those spots. If you talk to them, and I've talked to some people in areas that are considered, you know, first up, nobody wants to leave their home. It's why it's such a thorny issue. So that's why when you talk about retreat or managed relocation or whatever you want to call it, it's an equity issue. Are we giving everyone the opportunity to leave before things get bad, or are we waiting till a Hurricane Sandy or an Andrew or a Michael rips you out of your home and then you can't afford to come back? That's the question. And that's sort of what we're looking at in the Keys.
Jenny.
And I would say that so far we're only talking about flooding in terms of where we go and it, whether or not we leave. Mm-hmm. What we're not looking at is what's it going to be like. If we don't deal with water quality issues, are we going to be surrounded by a yucky bay? Will we have dead reefs? Will we have, you know, no wildlife? Will wading birds leave the Everglades you know, there are these environmental questions that don't get answered.
Holly, before I come to you, because I want to know what people in the Keys are thinking, this leads to a question when we talk about neighborhoods that are changing and will continue to change. Our reporter, Nadej Green, spoke with Jesse Keenan, a Harvard University faculty member, out with a new report that explored the issue of climate gentrification. Here's what he said.
There were people that were telling me that they were moving from the beach, Miami Beach, and they were moving to the mainland because they thought in the long term that the high elevation on the mainland was something that was a superior economic investment.
All right. Now, one of the people that Nadej spoke to for her reporting was Louis Rosemont. He's a former Little Haiti resident. His landlord evicted him and all of his neighbors in a small two-story building because the landlord had plans to sell the land that it sits on. By the way, Louis' native language is Creole.
Et chaque jour, développeur a pas avancé à grand griffe. Mais son pays, c'est pouvoir avec l'argent pour gagner. Développeur gagne pouvoir, il gagne l'argent.
What he said in Creole. Everyday developers are advancing in Little Haiti. He says this is a country that runs on money and power. Developers have both. This comes back to city planning, this idea of changing neighborhoods. Phil Stoddard is a mayor. You know, how should we view this? Is this just going to be, as Mr. Rosemont said, developers are going to decide, and there's really nothing you could do about it?
Land trusts are probably the best thing we have going right now. And so getting funding and putting together cooperative programs to purchase some of this land, just like a developer does, only they keep the properties available for the residents. And that's probably the most effective thing.
Because in this case, you're talking about some of these neighborhoods, by the way, it's because they're higher up.
Yeah.
And so now
the ridge.
So the land is more valuable.
I mean, historically what happened in Miami was that the wealthy settlers settled along the coasts because it was lovely and beachy and nice. And then the communities that did the labor lived farther to the west. And just by a fluke of history and geology, the low-income neighborhoods wound up on high ground.
Our very own Nadej Green is right here. So everyone, give her a hand, please.
One thing I do want to say is that, so it was not a fluke that Black neighborhoods ended up on high elevation in the city of Miami and across Miami-Dade County. When redlining occurred in the 1930s, you will see that most of the predominantly Black neighborhoods, Liberty City, Little Haiti, parts of unincorporated North Miami-Dade County, sit along the coast, the ridge that also corresponds with Henry Flagler's Railroad. And that was a direct result of racist housing policy. So redlining was such that low-lying areas, the coastal areas where white people lived, were graded A or B. The areas where Black folks lived or where it was anticipated Black people would live were graded D or F. It was considered hazardous. And so that is why Black folks disproportionately are on that ridge in high elevation.
And now that land is
desirable.
It is desirable, right. So these once disinvested neighborhoods are now desirable because of where it sits as a result of climate change, as a result of rising seas. So that was very much by design, by federal housing policies. When it comes to what is occurring, like in Little Haiti, for example, and the concerns you're hearing in parts of Liberty City and even parts of Overtown is, you know, developers have been speculating in these areas for a while now. After the housing bust, land was cheap and people bought there, right? So you have that in its proximity to downtown Miami and Midtown. So you have what you would call regular gentrification, right? People are interested because it's close to the urban core and everyone is moving back to the urban core. But you also have this idea of, well, people do care now about elevation. I've talked to realtors and people who are shopping for homes and they will tell you that I am not looking for a home without an elevation map. I am considering topography when I'm looking in this area. And so what you're seeing also in these neighborhoods is fear that among the speculation that is happening, it's not just because it's close to the urban core, but because there is a very real knowing, all of the education that is happening, people know. There are folks who lived in the Grove who are like, I don't want to live here anymore, right? And they're moving out, and so where do they go?
Thank you for being here and clearing that up. Thank you, I appreciate it. We're going to continue this conversation. We've got to take a break. Continuing our town hall on climate risk, we'll be right back.
Thank you. your ground, deep inside, you got it down.
Welcome back to the WLRN Sundial Miami Herald Town Hall, again talking about climate risk today. This, of course, on the heels of the Democratic debates over the next couple of days, Wednesday and Thursday, 20 candidates are going to try to sell themselves to the voters and convince you that they are the right person to support for the 2020 election. Let me reintroduce again the cast that we have with us today. WLRN's environmental reporter, Jenny Siletovich. I'm going from my left to the right. The Miami Herald's climate change reporter, Alex Harris. Climate change educator and founder of the Clio Institute, Caroline Lewis. FIU professor of biology and the mayor of South Miami, Phil Stoddard. And Republican state representative from District 120, covering the Keys, Holly Rashine. I do want to mention, too, by the way, just as a note, that WLRN has a weekly text letter dedicated to environmental news. You can sign up by texting the words Enviro News, and I'll give the number out in case if anybody here doesn't get it. It's 305-363-6687. Standard messaging rates apply. Again, a weekly text newsletter that comes out covering the issue. I wanted to come back to our audience. We have an audience member, Sam, who's been waiting. Sam, go ahead and ask your question.
Well, thank you for having us, of course. And my name is Sam. I'm from South Miami, actually. And my question is, I know you guys are just talking about land trust, but how do we ensure that the poorest and most vulnerable amongst us aren't displaced by the people with the ability and money to force us out of their out of our neighborhoods in search of climate resiliency? And moreover, how do we address current climate refugees here in the United States and abroad? Thank you.
And this continues the conversation that we had just a little while ago. So as we learned, obviously, there are neighborhoods that are higher up than others, and that's attractive. Caroline Lewis, you were just talking during the break about something you had shown to a group of students, I believe, at FIU on this.
No, it was actually in Little Haiti.
Thank you.
We were in Little Haiti and in Liberty City separate times. And I think one of the ways we can protect the most vulnerable is this time with visual education, where we show them the Eyes on the Rise app from FIU, where you just Google it, eyesontherise.org, and we show them Miami-Dade County. And we did inundation levels at 2 feet, 4 feet, 6 feet, 8 feet. And you could see the room just went, because they realized that their land was still dry, whereas the east and the west coast, with sea level rise, inundating and encroaching, and they understood that they were undesirable. So if you own property on the ridge, as Najet said, where the railroads were built and where we sent the black and brown people to live, and you are an informed homeowner and you choose to sell for its correct value, good for you. But to feel preyed upon, the homeowners that are preyed upon right now, the Clio Institute is working with a group of architects and engineers and the city of Miami to refurbish 4 of those homes for residents there at no cost to them, if we can help it. And so it's things like that that helps educate them. But in terms of being able to afford to live in an area that's gentrifying so rapidly, it's going to be tough.
There was another question that's coming from our audience. Valerie Howell, who's here, wanted to ask this question. With the inevitable sea level rise making South Florida uninhabitable in 100 years, what should we be doing right now to prepare for the evacuation of the region and the flooding flow? Caroline Lewis.
We have two tribes. We have the hell no, we won't go kind of people. And then we have the people who just can't wait for me to stop talking to ask me, so when should I sell? And I think the answer is, how risk averse are you, right? Because if you have all the equity in your life in one home, you don't want to wait until a disaster hits and wipes it out. You no longer have that equity. However, if you have the freedom and you own your house or you are not worried about walking away from it, then you stay.
Jenny, go ahead.
Well, I have a question for the politicians here, which is, Florida used to have a Department of Community Affairs that managed and controlled growth. That went away. What role
didn't
do
go
you
away.
Think government...
It was taken away.
Okay, well, so what role
it
do
was
you
morphed.
Think... that should that come back? What role does government play in regulating where housing can go? How much housing should we be building in these vulnerable areas? Should government step in and say no?
In the Keys, they do. They step in and say no. Obviously, we're under a very rigorous growth, rate of growth ordinance, or ROGO, when it comes to building in the Keys and development in the Keys. We will, you know, stop development at some point. Or
aren't
new,
you coming
new
up on a cap?
We are, actually. We're slated in 2023 to reach our build-out where, you know, no new building permits will be available. And while this is kind of an extreme end of the spectrum, maybe other more sensitive areas in Florida would want to consider something like this.
And I think there's another, dare I say, more conservative approach to this, which is to say, to make everybody responsible for their own mess. So if you want to build a nuclear plant, one of the rules is you have to put money aside to decommission it. So I would say if you want to build a high-rise on the coast, you've got to put money aside to decommission it. Who's going to clean up the mess after I leave?
Holly said something interesting. Let me just, you know, be the one who maybe throws the match in there. The Keys are unique. You have to have a limit. You have to say we can't anymore, can't take anymore. Should you put a cap on how many people can move in?
We do.
But the Keys are unique. Mm-hmm. Can Miami, Fort Lauderdale?
Well, the Keys cap is based on hurricane evacuation, correct? So
correct.
You could argue South Florida may have a...
And Florida's a terrible place to try to evacuate anyway.
And we did have a rule for a while based on water supply. And now what's happening is that the county is starting to desalinate. It's pretty expensive, but that's what we're doing. Because we have now exceeded the capacity of the Biscayne Aquifer.
By the way, I don't want to say to everybody who might be watching this on Facebook, don't come to South Florida. I'm not pleased. I don't want to say that. I know.
Come and spend money.
Come and spend money.
What you just said right there is the question, right? This is an economy that runs entirely on growth and development, that if you cut that off at the knees, it's where are we going to get our money from? And it's not that we don't need to not stop it. It's just we need to think about where to go from there.
And right? I think everybody agrees that we should not be building out into the western suburbs. You know, we shouldn't be building the 836 extension and encouraging development beyond the urban development boundary. We should be putting more height and density near the transit stations. And that's a pretty straightforward solution that lowers carbon expenditure, lowers carbon footprint, lets people walk, and ultimately produces a better outcome.
We have another question from our audience. Welcome. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. My name is Elizabeth. I'm from Miami. And my question is, what are the legislators currently doing to help homeowners get their insurance claims resolved quickly enough so we can fix our homes and improve our properties and make them environmentally safe?
Holly Rashad.
Ooh, yeah, I knew that was going to be mine. Well, so Citizens Property Insurance, is that your company, your policy?
Yes.
Policy holder? Well, we, again, life is always a learning. There's a steep learning curve, especially after natural disaster. And what we did in the Keys, because there was just the sheer amount of claims was huge. And we brought them into the community. And we had pop-up sites starting in Key Largo, obviously many of them in the middle North Keys where the storm made landfall and then further down. But I think that one of the biggest accomplishments that we did this year was pass AOB reform, assignment of benefits. That is something that's an issue that's been plaguing our state, and especially South Florida, with regards to the amount of fraud and abuse that we've been seeing. That issue drives our rates up and therefore complicates the whole issue. Homeowners don't get paid, their homes don't get repaired, trial lawyers, no offense, get involved, and it's a big mess. But we did pass significant reform this year, and I think you're going to continue to see that. Unfortunately, we're going to experience another natural disaster, and more lessons will be learned. But I think that's the goal, at least, of Citizens Property Insurance, and I hope other...
And this is for anybody on the panel, but when do insurance companies start looking at South Florida saying, well, it's not even worth being there anymore?
They have assured me they will always be here. We mightn't be able to afford it, but that they would.
Right, because flood insurance right now, the National Flood Insurance Policy, which is from FEMA, which most people get their flood insurance from, is currently considering how to change their policy to go from the way we have it now, which is heavily subsidized. If any of you own homes, you know that your flood insurance is generally a lot cheaper than your windstorm insurance. And they want to change the flood insurance to be more risk-based, to actually reflect what you're looking at. The last time anyone tried to do that, it skyrocketed costs. Specifically in the Keys was the danger zone. Mm-hmm. And how, homes that were used to paying $2,000 a year ended up paying $15,000, mm-hmm. something like that. Crazy numbers.
$45,000.
Right. Yeah. Insane prices. Or are not insane. Question is, like, that is that... Are we actually charging people the appropriate amount for the risk in the neighborhoods they're going to live in? Okay, fine. You want to live in a hurricane zone? Are you willing to pay $45,000 a year to make sure that if your home gets wiped out, you can replace it? Or is it smarter to just leave? It's a financial incentive.
Well, and the other thing I'm thinking is, I mean, if there are certain neighborhoods that are going to flood out at some point, insurance companies, banks are going to say, we don't want to go anywhere near that neighborhood.
Well, I had an insurance analyst for a reinsurance company point out something. And this comes back to the word climate risk. What happens when climate change and the effects of it are no longer a risk but a certainty? So when you're getting floods in your yard every year, there's not a risk of a flood. It's a guaranteed thing. And insurance companies flood against true risk. They don't insure against guaranteed likelihoods. And so there comes a transition point for an insurance company when they say, this is no longer an insurable risk. This is a certainty. And we can talk about amortizing your repair costs, but that's not what insurance companies do. And they say at that point, we're out of that marketplace.
Let me kind of bigger scope here when we talk about this issue, because, again, it can be very overwhelming. It's a topic that covers so much. Our reporter, Katie Switalski, spoke with Elizabeth Schwartz, an attorney and activist based in Miami, and she had this to say of what she would ask the Democratic presidential candidates.
No one scares me more than the real climate change activists because they say this isn't something we're going to recover from in a generation or two. This is going to be this might be permanent damage that is being done to our climate. So my question would be, because it feels so futile, what can be done? What can you do if you become president of the United States? What can you do to reverse some of this damage?
Caroline Lewis, I'll start with you. Can somebody reverse it?
I think the Paris Agreement was the first time I slept well. When there is a global effort, it's like climate risk is like a boat with a hole in it, and all we're doing is figuring out how to bail the water better, how to hire more bailers, a better scoop, but at some point we got to fix the hole. So I think we need a leader who will do this American thing. I became an American because of this American dream. My husband was born in Miami. He talked about watching Superman every Saturday, and it's like truth, justice, and the American way, and he wants that back. And so I want a leader who is going to take the country and the world and just say, we're not going to let this happen.
As we finish up here, to my reporters, briefly, you cover the issue on a local regional level, but this is a global issue. How do you feel personally as you're covering stories? Are you thinking about your readers, your listeners here? Or it's like, well, no, this is kind of affecting all of us. Jenny?
I'm thinking about my readers. I think my job
your
is
listeners,
to...
Your listeners, sorry.
my listeners right. now. But I feel like, our job is to inform, and then you guys make your informed decisions based on the information that we provide in the best way that we can and the most comprehensive and connect the dots. That's a huge part of what I try to do.
And Alex Harris, I wonder, too, what your readers ask you for.
I think the number one question people ask me is, what can I do? And that's just such a broad question. You can vote, you can go vegan, you can reduce your meat, you can carpool. But I mean, when I look at my readers and I think about my audience and when I write these stories, what I want to do is exactly what we just talked about here. People who are too busy, I want to tell you why this matters to you. I want to talk about why climate change affects your wallet, why it affects your septic tank, why it affects what you're going to eat tomorrow. And hopefully, you know, you can see that and I'll be someone who can watch for you and say, these are the issues. Your elected officials are doing the right thing, are doing the wrong thing. Here's an issue you should care about. Here's something you should put your attention into, and just making it easier to understand.
Well, on that note, we have to stop. Unfortunately, we are out of time. Let me thank everybody here again, WLRN's environmental reporter Jenny Stiletovich, the Miami Herald's climate change reporter Alex Harris, climate change educator and founder of the Clio Institute Caroline Lewis, FIU professor of biology and the mayor of South Miami Phil Stoddard, and Republican state representative covering District 120, covering the Keys, chair also of the Agriculture and Natural Resources Appropriations Subcommittee Holly Rashine. Thank you, all of you, so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And by the way, thank you, all of you who come in today. Thank you so much. Thank you for your questions. I want to thank my producers, Chris Remington and Alejandro Martinez, the WLRN television crew for today's Facebook Live. That was directed by Douglas Clark. Chris DeAngelis has been running the board for sound. And really, again, a big applause for all of you. Thank you again for your support for public radio.